BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I was surprised that President Bashar al-Assad looked so relaxed when he gave me an interview in his palace in Damascus at the beginning of 2015.
You've lost control of large areas of Syria.
The war in Syria was going badly for his regime.
There are perhaps 200,000 Syrians dead, millions have lost their homes.
I assumed that his media advisor, a clever woman who was a former journalist, would have talked him through answers to some of the obvious questions I was going to ask.
Has Syria become a failed state?
One of them was about the well-documented Syrian practice of dropping barrels full of explosives on areas held by the rebels. They were known as barrel bombs, and they were the very definition of an indiscriminate civilian killing weapon. I had seen the damage they could do in areas rebels had captured in Damascus.
These were blocks of flats. The laws of war say all sides should distinguish between civilians and fighters. Almost every building in Douma is damaged, which suggests it's all being treated as a military target. They said they saw the bomb, a barrel of explosive, dropped in this net from a helicopter. The regime's blitz is breaking the city and breaking lives.
So, I was surprised when instead of finding some kind of justification, President Assad denied they even had them.
But you wouldn't deny that included under the category of bombs are these barrel bombs, which are indiscriminate weapons.
No, there's no indiscriminate weapons.
It was a lie, a big one.
There's no barrel bomb.
And I seized on it gratefully.
Can't all have been lying, surely.
How surely? Why are you sure?
I thought his lie was backfiring on him, especially when he tried to turn it into a joke.
I haven't heard of army using barrels or maybe cooking pots.
And then I realised that he had a strategy for the interview. It just wasn't the one I'd expected.
Large barrels full of explosives and projectiles, which are dropped from helicopters and explode with devastating effect. There's been a lot of testimony about these things.
There's no indiscriminate weapons.
There's no barrel bombs at all.
We don't have barrels. Again, it's like talking about cooking pots. So we don't have cooking pots.
In this series, we've been looking at some of the obstacles that stand between journalists and the truth. A lie is a big obstacle. President Assad was not, it seemed, interested in changing minds among the hundreds of millions who'd see the interview on the BBC. Instead, his priority was sending a consistent message to people in Syria. Whether or not he was being truthful wasn't the issue. Their leader had to be defiant. A key technique is never to admit you're wrong. Repeat the lie often enough, and sooner or later, people will believe it. I think that was in Assad's mind, and not just him.
We're at a point in public life where politicians tell more lies.
Big lies were a big issue for Dean Baquet when he was executive editor of the New York Times.
I mean, the whole attack on the election system.
This is a fraud on the American public.
One big lie was Donald Trump's repeated allegation that he'd lost the 2020 U.S. presidential race because it was stolen from him in a huge electoral fraud.
They can try to steal the election from us.
When there's been no proof or even evidence that elections were meddled with is a lie.
We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list, okay?
And I think that even though the standard lie of politicians, which was, this is only gonna cost $1 billion, I promise you, as they knew it was gonna cost 10 billion. Or we believe that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. That's always existed. But I think there's something a little bit more public now about the lies politicians tell.
The question for journalists is how they deal with that. This is Frontlines of Journalism, Episode 10, The Big Lie. Rallying supporters with a big lie isn't new. It was one of Hitler's favorite tricks. The Nazis' genocidal racial fantasies about a Jewish conspiracy were built on a huge pyramid of lies. Hitler's techniques and those of Stalin, the Soviet dictator, were studied by Hannah Arendt, one of the most famous political thinkers of her time. She was a Jew who escaped Nazi Germany and settled in the United States. In her book, On Totalitarianism, published in 1951, Hannah Arendt wrote about the power of lies. She said that the masses, faced with an ever-changing, incomprehensible world, could believe everything and nothing, think that everything was possible and nothing was true. Mass propaganda, she wrote, discovered that its audience was ready at all times to believe the worst, no matter how absurd, and didn't particularly object to being deceived, because it held every statement to be a lie anyhow. Authoritarian states in the 21st century have not achieved the level of totalitarian control of the last century's dictators. But they still deploy the big lie to control their supporters and justify the punishment, sometimes the killing, of people who challenge the lies they tell. Since 2009, BBC Persian, broadcasting from London, has been offering Iranians an alternative to the state media's version of the truth. It reaches around one-fifth of the population of Iran, about 13 million people. Rana Rahimpour was one of BBC Persian's best-known journalists and presenters. It is not an easy job.
My colleagues in the Persian service, we haven't been able to go back to Iran since the Persian TV was launched. Family members have passed away. There's an asset freeze on everyone who works for the service. Yeah, it has been extremely tough.
You know, in the rest of the BBC, we complain about pressure, but it's nothing compared to what you guys have to face. Why is it so intense for BBC Persian?
Because the Iranian regime feels threatened and weakened. And it's always been hostile towards journalists. And don't forget that it's tough for us working in London, but it's far more dangerous for those who are working in Iran. Many journalists have been arrested since the beginning of protests in September. The price we are paying is nothing compared to the pressure that they're experiencing. But it's tough because the Iranian government doesn't want the people to know what's going on inside the country, so they would use any means to stop that.
The Iranian state does not provide officials for Rana and her colleagues to interview. But BBC Persian does run interviews with regime fellow travellers who can parrot the regime's falsehoods. In interviews, clever liars construct answers in layers. It starts with a false underlying premise, the foundation for a mix of details, accusations, and justifications that might be false or could be true.
I mean, I find it very difficult in that situation where they might be lying on multiple levels. Mm. How do you go about trying to expose that?
The key is having a good brief and knowing the history of the person. Many of these people appear on other channels and you get to know them and you expect them to lie and to be prepared beforehand and having your facts straight. But as you said, when the lying is multi-layered, it's very difficult.
For President Bashar al-Assad, the false underlying premise was that Syria's war came from a foreign conspiracy.
It's like if you have invasion of terrorists coming from abroad.
Not from an uprising against his regime.
And the government is doing its job in fighting and defending its country.
Journalists have to challenge lies, however well constructed, and that can make them the target of the lie machine.
We've been lied a lot about Bellingcat by Russian officials.
Elliot Higgins, founder of Bellingcat.
Following the 2018 investigation we did into the Skripal poisoners, where we were able to identify two individuals who appeared on Russia Today as sports nutrition salesmen.
Our friends had been suggesting for a long time that we visit this wonderful town.
Salisbury? A wonderful town?
It's famous for its 123-meter spire.
It's actually two GRU agents. The Russian ambassador to the UK gave a press conference and he repeatedly said that Bellingcat is working for the UK security services and is funded by the security services.
The source is the Bellingcat, which has a very close link to the British special services.
And he said that several times in this press conference.
Bellingcat is not a media. This is the tool for the deep establishment to leak certain things.
And it's very frustrating when it's about you and they're telling lies, but it's also a reflection of how worried they are about us, that they have to bring us up multiple times, but they don't actually have real evidence to support their claims against us.
The day we spoke to Rana for this series in mid-January was her first day back with the BBC Persian service after 2.5 months away from work.
It's like going back into the battlefield.
Tell us why you had to take 2.5 months off work.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guards had wiretapped my conversations with my parents, who live in Iran. And then they manipulated them. They cut and paste parts of my conversation in order to show that I was supporting their narrative of the protests. They broadcast it and they published it on their news agencies, and a lot of people believed it. And then I received a barrage of death threats and rape threats against myself and my family in Iran and my children. And it reached a point that I couldn't take it anymore. We decided to shut down all my social media and take some time off work. It was very, very difficult.
I must be horrendous. I mean, how do you feel now about to step back into the studio?
I'm anxious. I thought I have managed to grow a thick skin because we're not unfamiliar with threats and trolling online. But I know that the moment I appear on the BBC Persian TV again after 2.5 months, there's going to be another wave of attacks against myself and the service.
Why do you stick it out? You could have an easier life doing something else, couldn't you?
It's a very good question, Jeremy. It's partly our personalities, I think. There's a fire inside you, there's a drive, and you feel that you have to do it. And on top of that, when I think about our colleagues inside Iran who are in prison, and I feel that, yes, it's difficult for me, but I'm living in London in safety. And if I don't do it, who else would do it? So somebody has to carry the torch to continue the fight and to continue to inform and educate the people.
Rana and her colleagues chose a hard road. Since we interviewed her, Rana has left the BBC, though she's staying in journalism. Listeners might have noticed that I am deeply biased in favour of journalism and journalists. In almost 40 years of reporting around the world, most of the journalists I've known have tried to get to that best obtainable version of the truth. They have different ways of going about it. Some see themselves as activists or commentators. George Orwell's statue stands outside his old workplace, broadcasting house in London, where I'm sitting. He said being partisan was always his point of departure, but Orwell's destination was truth. At the BBC in this century, our starting point is different. But impartiality, as you've heard, doesn't mean neutrality. And getting to the truth is still the aim. In the world that we've created, journalism is more important than ever, but only if people believe our stories. If they don't, there's no point. In the worst times in the 20th century, as Hannah Arendt wrote, clever totalitarians told lies to explain a world that was incomprehensible and ever-changing. It sounds a bit like today. Frontlines of Journalism is presented by me, Jeremy Bowen. The producer is Georgia Catt. The assistant producer is Sam Peach. Additional research by Rob Byrne. Series mixing by Jackie Marjoram. The series editor is Philip Sellers. Please rate and leave a review to help others find us.